Good morning. You're tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. Coming up next, we have a special from WERU reporter Carolyn Coe.
Independent, unembedded U.S. journalist and photographer Dar Jamil has spent a total of 8 months in occupied Iraq. A fourth-generation Lebanese-American, Jamil reported from Iraq between November 2003 and February 2005. He has also reported from Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon. His reports are published by Interpress Service, The Asia Times, The Nation, and The Guardian. His portrait is included in the collection Americans Who Tell the Truth by Brooksville artist Robert Shetterly. On September 28th, Dar Jamil gave the Howard Schoenberger Peace and Justice Lecture, The Ground Truth Today in Iraq, at the University of Maine. His orange shirt was bright, but not his report on the situation in Iraq. Dar Jamil.
Wow, there's a lot I want to try to cover tonight, but first things first, I want to thank the Schoenbergers and the Schoenberger Committee for inviting me here. I was thinking earlier about what would this country look like if, to honor a loved one who passed, some of those family members and maybe some other people got together and decided we're going to start an event, raise funds for it every year in this person's memory, to work that will go towards social justice and making the world a little bit better place. What if every family did something like that? Maybe not quite as grand as this, but even on a small scale, what would this country look like? It's a really neat deal, and I'm really honored to have been invited to speak tonight and be a part of that. Now we're well over 3.5 years into the occupation of Iraq. To be optimistic about it, it's actually a hopeful thing to me that a large number of people would turn out to hear more bad news from Iraq at this stage of the game. But I think it's critical. I was in Alaska working as a mountain guide and a volunteer rescue ranger on Mount McKinley. I had a really wonderful life. I got to climb all summer and get paid for it sometimes, and traveled some of the other time, and then backpack around that state. And, I had a great life. I live in this country. I was privileged enough to be born here and born white and born into at least a relatively fair degree of privilege. And I used it, and I really didn't think about it. And things didn't start to change for me until I did begin to travel around a bit and see how most of the rest of the world was living. And but back to the political forces here that kind of urged me to go to Iraq was reading, once I kind of became politicized enough to realize that there's the power of the media. And I was reading when push came to shove and it became very clear that the U.S. was going to go into Iraq, I was reading vociferously all the foreign news I could, like journalists like Robert Fisk, who writes for The Independent in the U.K., even foreign papers like Haaretz in Israel, the English paper, Al Jazeera's English website, just to name a few. And the information I was getting there was almost as if they were reporting on a totally different situation compared to what the corporate media here was showing. When we look at the corporate media before the buildup to the war in Iraq, they were pretty much lockstep in getting out the information the Bush administration wanted people here to see about that war. They were so effective and so powerful with their propaganda that today, the most recent poll I've seen found 45% of the people in this country still believe that there were links between Saddam Hussein and Iraq and the events of September 11, 2001. Thus is the power of propaganda, of the corporate media, of brainwashing people. And I think it's important to note that when I remember in some of my high school history classes studying World War II, we learn about German propaganda and Japanese propaganda and, pick a country. They all had their propaganda and we all knew their governments lied. But it never dawned on me to think that, well, the American government, maybe they would do the same thing. as well. And I just didn't think that. And of course, we weren't taught that in school, no way. And, you know, that's, I think, really the heart of the problem right now in this country is that a lot of people don't understand that this country right now, with the corporate media and all of their interests being so in line with those of the government and the people behind the government, that I think we have the most sophisticated propaganda system in this country ever before. In fact, in the year 2006, roughly the Pentagon budget was $600 billion. $200 billion of that budget, one-third went to psychological operations. And that's psychological operations overseas, of course, but that's also psychological operations here. Most people in this room are probably all too aware of the fact that, like the Lincoln Group, for example, that just got another contract to continue their work in planting false news stories in Iraqi media. Well, again, we need to understand very clearly that that type of thing is going on here right now as we speak, and it's quite well documented, actually. So this level of propaganda and the sell job that I was seeing before I went into Iraq being conducted by the corporate media, and which I'm sure is the same sell job that most of you are all too aware of, the lies, the WMDs, the weapons, you know, weapons of mass destruction, 45 minutes to an attack if you're Tony Blair, and mushroom clouds and chemical weapons and tons of chemical weapons everywhere, and these unmanned drones that they're going to deliver them with, and on down the line, just total nonsense that we all know. Now it's extremely clear. Even Mr. Bush, Cheney's spokesman, has been very clear himself and even said, no links to 9/11, no weapons of mass destruction, but still 45% of the people here in the country think otherwise. But this is the very long-winded way of saying this is what led me to go to Iraq, was the level of information control was such that it was clear to me that's how governments get away with things, and that's how this government is getting away with invading this country, with breaking international law, with waging a war of aggression, despite the fact that the most massive protests in the history of the world occurred to try to stop it, despite the fact that all the facts were already available for anyone who was willing to read them, and got away with it. And I watched the invasion happen. I was glued to the news, reading everything I could get, and I just became angrier and angrier, and I did the usual things that, as a citizen of this country, I was taught and what I learned to do to express dissent. I went to demonstrations. I wrote countless letters to my representatives up in Alaska. I made phone calls. I did some direct actions. I tried to inform people. I started writing political articles in the newspaper I was writing for up there before they fired the editor because we got too political. And nothing worked. You know, and February 15 came and went, the invasion happened, and I decided, well, one thing I can do is go over and try to just write about what I see, because everything I'm reading over there is quite different from what's being reported in the corporate media. And that'll be my drop in the bucket. I'll come back home. I'll be able to sleep better at night. And I'll feel like I've, you know, at least taken a risk and done something beyond what I've already done, which has clearly not been enough. And so I put my name on an independent media center Beirut list, and I found through that listserv someone who had just come out of Baghdad, who was in there writing really moving weblogs about what he was seeing in there. And then I met with him very briefly in Beirut, and we talked about, go to this hotel in Jordan, you can rent a car there, pay a driver to take you into Baghdad, stay at this hotel in Baghdad, you should be okay, you'll meet some people there you can probably team up with. And so that's basically how I went in. I really wasn't an official journalist. I didn't have a press card, so I made one. I got online, and you can Google press badge, and you'll have a million examples. And I knew in Baghdad that basically, since there was no state, they removed Saddam Hussein, they set up this green zone, and effectively there was no state. So basically, any piece of plastic with your picture on it, hanging on a lanyard around your neck, you're official. What do you want to be? Press, police, okay, you better get a shirt to match it, but you're official. And it worked. You know, in Baghdad, you get there and you walk up to a checkpoint and, what are you doing here? I'm press. Okay, go on in. I mean, that was all there was to it. And I was fortunate enough to have gone in my first trip, November 03, where it was dangerous, but it was still relatively doable. There was some room for error, and I definitely made plenty of errors. But at that point, we went in, and we all stayed. When I say we, I mean other foreign journalists that were there and some activists. And we were all staying at a hotel called the Hotel Agadir, which is in central Baghdad. And there were no needs for guards at the hotel, no blast walls. There weren't suicide car bombs. Well, there were some, but not. It was very rare still. There was no kidnapping going on. So we all stayed there, and I met some people, and we started working together. And thus began what was to become, so far, has been a three-year journey of where I ended up working as a journalist. And it certainly wasn't my goal or my plan, but it's just how it worked out. And I'll come back to a little bit more on that later, but now I want to get to talking about a little bit more of the media and the state of our media in this country, and then get you up to speed on what the situation is right now today, like on the ground in Iraq. And I like to start with this quote from a senior producer at the Al Jazeera Arabic satellite TV channel. His name is Samir Khadr, and I met him. He's a really, really kind man, very good journalist, very good at what he does. I met him at an Al Jazeera conference in Doha, Qatar. And the quote that I'm going to use from him, though, is at the beginning of a documentary called Control Room, which was about Al Jazeera. And any of you who have seen that documentary, you'll remember this quote where he said, "You cannot wage a war without rumors, without media, without propaganda. Any military planner who plans for a war, if he doesn't put media propaganda on top of his agenda, he's a bad military." And I like to follow that quote with one from the United States chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, the highest-ranking member of the U.S. military, when on this past March 5th, he was on the Meet the Press show, and he was being interviewed by Tim Russert. And this was at a time when Iraq was, of course, continuing to degrade, but it had just followed a week of spectacular, coordinated suicide bombings. Hundreds of people were dead. More and more bodies daily were turning up on the streets, and the condition was just spiraling a bit faster downwards than usual. And it was very clear that it was getting dramatically worse. And so Tim Russert asked him, "How are things going in Iraq? How would you describe it?" And General Peter Pace said, quote, "I'd say they're going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything you look at." So that was roughly 3 years into the occupation, and you know, the silver lining to that cloud is I felt like, well, at least I have job security. And so I want to talk about what very, very well looks like on the ground in Iraq today. And the first and most important statistic I'll talk about all night is how many Iraqi civilians have died as a result of the U.S. invasion and occupation. And there's a bit of a dispute about this number. For example, even Bush, I think it was a couple of months ago, said, yeah, it's around 30,000. And I think he got that number from the website Iraq Body Count, which is a website that was set up at the very beginning of the invasion after General Tommy Franks and some others had said, we don't do body counts. And it was a very noble cause. They set up this website and said, well, we're going to try to track it. The problem is, and their number today is somewhere between 35 and 45,000. And the problem is their criteria is that they only report deaths that have been reported by three different media sources. So that's one criteria, which is a bit problematic in Iraq. And then the second is all of those media sources have to have an English website. And then they have some other limitations. But those are the two main ones that I think are really, really, really critical. And even the people that run this project have said, yeah, our number's probably at least twice as low as what it ought to be. But the problem is, since they haven't come out and been very clear about why their number is dramatically low, that number continues to be cited even in the anti-war camp, and then, of course, by our illustrious Mr. Bush. which is a bit problem. I mean, I think if I were running a project and Mr. Bush was citing my figures, I might get a little concerned about that. But anyway, that's I want to come around to, I think, the most accurate survey done to date is that of the Lancet survey that was published in the Lancet UK Medical Journal. It's the most prestigious medical journal in the UK. And this was released on October 29, 2004. And this study found 98,000 excess deaths generated from the invasion and occupation. This number now is far, far too low, which has even been spoken of by Les Roberts, one of the co-authors of this report, who just this past early spring came out and said, we need to be talking about now, since it's long past October 2904, that number is probably more in the realm of either 200 or as many as 300,000 dead Iraqis for several reasons. One, the study is now grossly out of date. Two, it didn't include areas of major combat operations because they didn't want to skew the survey. So they didn't include the Fallujahs and the Najafs. That's upwards of another 10,000 right there. And then three, and one of the most important elements is that to do a study like this, you have to have a baseline, which naturally had to be pre-invasion. So their baseline was the last 17 months of the sanctions, when over a million Iraqis died from diseases, lack of food, starvation, malnutrition, waterborne diseases, this kind of thing. So that's the baseline. So all of these factors together point to the bottom line fact that I think that you could easily, comfortably argue that a quarter of a million Iraqis have died directly as the result of the invasion and occupation. The next most important statistic I think I can talk about tonight is how many U.S. soldiers have been killed or wounded in this occupation. And to date, the number has just passed 2,700. It's a few over that. I don't know the exact number. I haven't checked it in a couple of days. 2,700 soldiers dead, according to the DOD, 10 times that number wounded, conservatively. I think the number of wounded is actually notably higher than that, as many as 45,000. One-third of all soldiers coming back have severe PTSD. This just came out. This is because the troop shortage on the ground in Iraq is so thin. Just this past week, we saw 3,800 National Guards people over in Iraq have their tours extended. So they'll have been there over a year by the time they leave. We have a situation where soldiers on the ground are being wounded and then being put back out on the street to do patrols that very same day. That's how short and thinned out the U.S. military is in Iraq right now. They're being attacked right now on average 120 times every single day. This past month alone has been one of the bloodiest this year so far. We're averaging about 2.5 being killed every single day, and again, 10 times that number wounded. And then they come back to a VA where right now the VA is so stretched thin. They have budget cuts coming up, billions of dollars of budget cuts from this administration that, of course, won't go into effect until after Bush leaves office. But on a VA that is already stretched so thin that the average wait for a soldier who needs services when he comes home is 6 months. There is an average of one psychologist accessible to military members in Iraq per 10,000 troops. It's well documented, and the Pentagon's even had to respond to the fact that there have been soldiers come in suicidal to talk to doctors and try to get help in Iraq and then been given drugs and sent back out to do patrols and do home raids. Another important thing to talk about now is death squads in Iraq. And when that first Lancet study was released, the 98,000 dead, they found that 85% of all those deaths were generated directly by occupation forces. While the U.S. military continues to kill very large numbers of Iraqis at checkpoints and sometimes accidental killings and other times by warplanes, and still continues to generate a very, very large number of the dead, death squads have now surpassed them as far as the actual percentage of Iraqis being killed. And I want to go into share some important details about the death squads in Iraq, because right now there's a lot of talk, well, is there civil war, is there not civil war? Should we stay or should we go? And if we leave, the Iraqis are just going to all kill each other. We can't leave. And you know, the death squads right now, there's an average of about 100 bodies every single day in Baghdad alone turning up on the streets by these death squads. It's a horrific scene. It's a nightmarish scene in Baghdad today. People wake up and look out on their streets and hope that they don't find bodies. They're turning up with their eyes gouged out, with drills having been drilled into their joints and in their jaws, limbs broken, very clear signs of torture all up and down their bodies before most of the time they're executed by being shot in the head. Sometimes there's piles of heads found in the streets. And many of these signs, many of these tactics, many of these torture tactics we see now in Iraq are mere images of the bodies that would turn up in Central America from those death squads in the 80s. And there's a reason for that, a very well-documented and very clear reason for that. There was a UN Human Rights report that was released on 8 September 05, which held Interior Ministry forces responsible for an organized campaign of detentions, torture, and killings. These, quote, special police commando units, end quote, recruited from the Badr and Mahdi armies, these are the two largest Shia militias in Iraq, were trained by the U.S. In fact, retired Colonel James Steele, counselor for the Iraqi security forces to U.S. Ambassador, former U.S. Iraqi Ambassador John Negroponte, supervised that training. This is the same Colonel James Steele who was commander of the U.S. military advisor group in El Salvador from 1984 to 1986. He also smuggled weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua and lied about it to the Senate Intelligence Committee, as documented in the final report of the Iran-Contra special prosecutor. So when I was in Baghdad in November 04 and then in January 05, John Negroponte just happened to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq at that time. Retired Colonel James Steele just happened to still be training these special police commando units coming out of the Interior Ministry, which does have its own five-year advisor, a U.S. advisor serving a five-year term, as do all the other ministries in Iraq. And we started to see back then there was very clear evidence of death squads. There were bodies turning up. We were getting reports of Sunni imams, Sunni tribal leaders, Sunni resistance leaders being killed, raids being carried out. So we all knew on the ground in Baghdad that something was very amiss. And then in January 05 was when Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld came out and started talking about the Salvador option in Iraq. So it's very well documented that these death squads that were implemented by the U.S., just like the ones in Central America when John Negroponte and Colonel James Steele were there, they started to have an effect on the Iraqi resistance. But the problem is now they have spun completely out of their control. Whether that's by design or not is arguable. But the bottom line is these death squads have spun completely out of control. The U.S. cannot control them. This is why they're starting to attack the Mahdi army again. They're going into Sadr City again right now and to try to contain it, but it's not going to work. And this has basically been the start and the fomentation of civil war in Iraq, which has been going on at night, kind of under cover of darkness, mainly by these death squads. Of course, the Sunnis have responded by setting up their death squads, and so have the Kurds. And this is civil war. Civil war is ongoing now in Iraq, and I would argue that it's been going on since January 05 at the latest. I think probably even earlier than that. So life in Baghdad that's an idea of the security situation. There's car bombs every day. There's open fighting in the streets every day. Anyone anywhere can just walk up to someone, kill them, and walk away. No one's going to say anything because they don't want to get killed either. There is literally no state. And this is really a hard thing for us here in the United States to imagine, you know, because we have the all-powerful military. It's hard to imagine that someone might invade us and knock out our government. but let's say for the sake of argument, China does. And they take out George Bush. Many of us would be very happy about that fact. But then as they occupied our country, and then it, as we saw over time, they really didn't have plans to leave and started to do horrible atrocities like killing your neighbors, doing home raids, detaining your brother. Maybe the odd woman would get raped as this occupation continues to degrade. You can kind of start to imagine the hell that Iraqis are living under. And the point is that when that state is erased, as what happened to the Saddam Hussein regime, there's nothing left. There's no security. There is no law. Police, why trust them? They're probably spies or collaborators anyway. So that's the situation now. There's literally zero security in Baghdad now. And then I want to talk a little bit about the infrastructure situation there. The infrastructure in Iraq today, the average house in all over Iraq, not just in Baghdad, but even up in the north Kurdish areas and far down south is Basra, the average house has about 2 hours of electricity per day. Probably about every second or third day you're going to have running water, but you better boil it first. There's 70% unemployment. There's 70% inflation. There has been basically little to no reconstruction carried out anywhere from southern Kurdistan down throughout the rest of Iraq. There have been some successful construction projects in the north, but from the southern part of the Kurdistan border down, there's basically no reconstruction happening. And I was hired in January 2004 by Public Citizen, a watchdog group out of D.C., to do a study on Bechtel and basically what they were accomplishing as far as the water infrastructure rehabilitation. It was in their contract. And so they hired me to do a report on this, and they gave me a copy of Bechtel's contract. And I want to just use this as an example of just a micro example of the infrastructure situation and kind of how this has gone in Iraq. And so what I did is I looked over their contract, and it's really vaguely written, big surprise. So it's tough to find specific completion dates for projects and where these projects are. And I did find three, though, and their completion dates, in Hilla, Najaf, and Diwaniya. Three cities all south of Baghdad. And I went down there, and it was either past or near the completion date of all of these projects. And I went to each water treatment plant with an interpreter and a photographer. And I spoke with either the head or the assistant engineer at each water treatment plant. And the best case scenario, one of them said, yes, some people from Bechtel came here and they changed our sand filters, but that doesn't actually produce any more potable water. If they would just give us the money or give us the equipment and let us do the work ourselves, which they weren't doing, we could take care of this. We rebuilt our country after the 91 war. We could do this in like 3 months, but they just won't let us do it. The worst case scenario, actually the case with the other two, was based when I asked them what work had Bechtel done, they basically said, Bechtel who? And again, said the same thing. Well, if they would just give us some of this money, we know. We read the news. We know that billions of U.S. dollars and billions of Iraqi dollars are being set aside for this reconstruction, but we're not seeing any of it. And what did this look like on the ground? I went, for example, to several villages on the outskirts of Najaf, which actually still fell under control of Najaf's water treatment plant. And I went to one, and their water source was... there was no running water in their taps as they were, so what these villagers did is they found where a pipe was about 4 feet underground, and they literally dug down into the dirt to this pipe, punched a hole in it, and then when the electricity ran, which was 2 hours a day, that hole, a dirt hole, would fill up with water, and that was their water source. And at that village alone, 8 children... who had been going across the street to a nearby factory who would sometimes give them potable water. 8 children had died crossing this highway back and forth to this factory to get water. And then the other main water source for this village was about half a mile away. So women had donkeys with these big leather bags on them that would hold water, and they would march the donkeys down this mud path to this little creek while it was running, which of course it didn't run in the summer, and fill them up and then walk them back. And what this meant was there was rampant cholera, rampant waterborne diseases, nausea, diarrhea, kidney stones. At one point, we were interviewing another village. It was this frenetic three-day trip where we were just interviewing hundreds of people, everyone we could talk to. They were basically all Shia. And all of them, even then in January 04, said, you know, it was better under Saddam Hussein, because at least then we could go get a job. At least then we had some water. At least then we had some electricity. And at one point, I remember we were interviewing people, and my interpreter just stopped translating. And he just turned around to me, and he was just exhausted. And he just said, I can't do this anymore. These people are asking me for help. There's nothing we can do. They just need water. What are we going to do? And by then, thankfully, we were already close enough towards the end of collecting this information. I said, all right, Hamoudi, okay, you know, thank them for their time. Tell them we'll write about it. It's the best we can do, and we'll move on. And we did. But that was one small example of what happened to Bechtel. Bechtel's initial contract was $680 million. It was signed. It's a no-bid, cost-plus, fixed-fee contract like most of them are in Iraq, which basically means you get paid no matter what. You get guaranteed a profit no matter what, even if you don't finish the project. And contractually, they're not in violation of their contract as long as they have someone, some guy on the ground somewhere in Iraq saying, yeah, we still plan to do that. They've been paid out in full for that contract already. They've since been awarded contracts totaling $3.8 billion. This is small change compared to the Halliburtons, for example, that have been awarded over $12 billion of contracts. And I'm being extremely conservative in these statistics. I think it's actually far greater than that at this point, just to give one other example. But that's the state of the infrastructure in Iraq, and that's the cause. And that's also the cause of this very astronomical level of anti-American sentiment now in Iraq. People are enraged. A lot of people believe the promises that were made to them, that we're going to bring you a better life, we'll get rid of Saddam, we're going to improve the infrastructure, give you jobs, and that just hasn't happened. And so at this point is when I like to repeat that General Peter Pace quote, just to show the contrast. Again, when he was asked how things in Iraq were going, I'd say they're going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything that you look at. And one thing I want to point out, I forgot to mention this earlier today, but I also want to talk about media complicity before I get too far away from what I talked about at the beginning of the discussion. And what most people in the United States don't know, that there are actually structures set up that are meant to govern and set up an ethics for the media during a time of war. There are two, actually. One was set up after the Nuremberg tribunals. We talk about German propaganda and what the media in Germany was able to pull off as far as convincing people that maybe the Holocaust was necessary. So the Nuremberg tribunals did address some standards that the media should adhere to during a time of war. Then there's also the UNESCO Charter for Journalism, both of which say that the primary responsibility of media during a time of war is not to incite the public to violence. Now, think about that as an ideal. And then remember what you saw in the corporate media in the lead up to the Iraq War. Outlets like CNN, it's not a news outlet, but propaganda channel Fox, and stenographers such as Thomas Friedman and Judith Miller of the New York Times, talking heads such as Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, are certainly guilty of inciting the public to violence and aiding and abetting in the war crimes and crimes against humanity, for arguing that the U.S. should violate the law by invading Iraq and making all of the aforementioned crimes I've discussed so far possible. Without a doubt, just to name a few, these outlets, these couple of journalists are complicit and the war crimes that have happened in Iraq by simply not doing their job as journalists. It's really important that people are really clear here about what are the future U.S. plans in Iraq, and I can state unequivocally that there is no plan for withdrawal ever. And there's hard evidence on the ground to support this, and there's hard evidence in military planning and strategy documents to support this as well. First, the U.S. embassy in Iraq. This is a embassy that, when it's completed, it's going to be a cluster of 21 buildings right in the middle of the green zone of Iraq, with walls reinforced 2.5 times their normal standards, and it will have room for over 8,000 government officials. It has a gym, the largest swimming pool in the country, barber and beauty shops, yoga studios, a cinema where they play first-run movies, which means they show when they come out and they're new here, they get showed at the same time in Iraq and Baghdad, a food court and a commissary, a large-scale barracks for troops, a school, not for Iraqis, locker rooms, a warehouse, vehicle maintenance garage, apartment buildings, and when it's finished, it's going to be two-thirds the area of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Another landmark to compare it to is that it's going to be the same size as the Vatican City. It's not your average embassy. I think you could argue that maybe this is going to be the new CENTCOM, which is now down in Doha, Qatar, the central command for U.S. military in the Middle East. It looks like they might be wanting to move that up into Baghdad, so it's a little bit closer to Iran. Another thing we can point to is that there are between 6 and 12 permanent U.S. military bases being constructed as we speak. Some are already finished. One of these, just to give an example of what these look like, is called Camp Anaconda in Balad. This base alone has 20,000 soldiers, less than 1,000 of whom ever leave the base. There's two base exchanges where they sell the latest high-tech gear like iPods and CDs and DVDs and DVD players, and one of the managers of these base exchanges boasted that he was happy to be selling 15 televisions a day to troops. There's also plans for more air-conditioned troop barracks and for these barracks to get internet, cable television, and overseas phone lines. There's thousands of civilian contractors at this base alone, so much so that they live in their own apartment cluster of apartment buildings called KBR land, as in Kellogg, Brown, and Root. This hospital on this one base alone, I talked about how many soldiers are being wounded in Iraq. This hospital alone is conducting 400 surgeries a month on injured soldiers. Air Force officials there claim that their runway is one of the busiest in the world. I don't know if it's true, but one of them claimed that it was second busiest, only behind Chicago O'Hare. The base has over 250 of its own aircraft. So we're talking transport planes, Apache helicopters, Chinook helicopters, F-16s, F-18s, unmanned military surveillance drones with their Hellfire missiles, just to name a few. There's lavish meals being served from what are known in Iraq as third country nationals. They call them TCNs. These are people from India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, or Bangladesh who come over and take these jobs because they're better paid than they can make back home. They're hired because it helps the profit margin of these companies because they can pay these guys and women even less than they pay Iraqis to do the same work. Plus, they just don't hire Iraqis because they don't trust them, because the resistance has basically infiltrated just about everything at this point. But if troops don't like these very, very lavish meals being served by these TCNs, and they are very good meals, you certainly can't argue that. There's also a 24-hour Burger King at Camp Anaconda, a Pizza Hut, a Popeyes, a Subway sandwich shop, and a Starbucks. This base, like the rest, has a swimming pool, first-run movie theater, and a Hertz rental car. There's several other gigantic bases like Camp Anaconda. For example, Camp Victory near the Baghdad airport. When it's finished, it's going to be twice the size of Camp Bonsteel in Kosovo, which was prior to Iraq, was one of the largest overseas bases the U.S. has built since Vietnam. and also had the distinction of being one of the few man-made structures visible from space. Well, now in Iraq, there's going to be a lot more. There are at least six of these types of bases in Iraq, and I'm a little vague on the number because it's hard to keep your finger on it because, for example, there's Camp Victory at Baghdad Airport, and then there's Camp Victory North, and they've essentially grown together. So is that one base or two? Will they, you know, how are they going to count that? And that's happened in more than one place. But the four primary bases, one is in Baghdad. There's one in Basra. There's one in Erbil up in the Kurdish north. And then there's one in Arrupa, which is in western Al-Anbar province near the border of Jordan. So there's no timetable from the I prefer to refer to it as the Cheney administration. Why not? I mean, you know, let's just be honest about who's really running the show. It's certainly not Mr. Bush. But even surprisingly reported by the New York Times on April 1903, 10 days after the fall of Baghdad, U.S. military officials said, quote, "There will probably never be an announcement of permanent stationing of troops in Iraq. Not permanent basing, but permanent access is all that is required," according to these military officials. So access is the key word. We're not going to have permanent bases. They're not permanent. We don't even have to call them bases. We just need access. And that is how it was written into the Iraqi Constitution. Again, I try to always remember to tell people that it's really important that people know that this Iraqi Constitution was written in English and translated into Arabic. And while all that haggling was going on during the referendum, just before it was put to a vote, it was about this access issue, and it was about U.S. withdrawal. And at the end of the day, it was, I'll paraphrase what it says in the Constitution, but it was then inserted into the Constitution that a foreign power, at the request of the Iraqi government, they left out the word puppet, would be allowed to access certain strategic military areas when necessary in Iraq, to paraphrase. So that's a pretty good clue. Another is in the 2002 National Security Strategy, and I encourage you, all this you can look it up online, have a read. It's really interesting reading. A quote from the 2002 National Security Strategy: "Our forces will be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. To accomplish this, the U.S. will require bases and stations within and beyond Western Europe and Northeast Asia." Now, before I finish with the rest of this, because it's more in line with this, think about this quote that, you know, as far as I know, it's never been reported anywhere in the corporate media, because it kind of contradicts this rhetoric, this propaganda coming out of the Cheney administration about, well, this is just about national security, or this is just to liberate the Iraqi people, or this is because Saddam Hussein was a threat. Because this quote that's in the national security strategy, that sounds a bit like empire to me. And these people don't like to talk about empire. They like to talk about terrorism. They like people to be afraid. And they have a corporate media that likes to report that kind of thing. But again, here's another clue. There's another military document called Joint Vision 2020. Makes for another very interesting read. I would really encourage you to read this one. And the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's vision here in Joint Vision 2020 is dedicated individuals and innovative organizations transforming the joint force, the U.S. military, of the 21st century to achieve, quote, "full spectrum dominance." They have that in bold type. "Persuasive in peace, decisive in war, preeminent in any form of conflict." Another clue comes from the Quadrennial Defense Review Report. The latest was released on February 6th of this year. Again, look it up, have a read. Really interesting stuff. There is a stated ability that the U.S. military can fight multiple overlapping wars, and to ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. I always like to read this quote twice because I think it's really important, and it's not one that you're going to hear on CNN or NBC or ABC or CBS. There is a stated ability of the U.S. military to fight multiple overlapping wars and to ensure that all major and emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system. So this is U.S. policy. This is what we can expect in the future. The report goes on to say that the U.S. will also seek to ensure that no foreign power can dictate terms of regional or global security. It will attempt to dissuade any military competitor from developing disruptive or other capabilities that could enable regional hegemony or hostile action against the U.S. or other friendly countries. And it will seek to deter aggression or coercion. Should deterrence fail, the U.S. will deny a hostile power its strategic and operational objectives. And then again, after that information, I like to read that General Pace quote again when asked how things were going in Iraq. I'd say they're going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they're going very, very well from everything you look at. As citizens of the empire, each of us has to decide what we can live with. And there's really no way for me to end this on an upbeat after dumping this massive amount of really bad news on you. But I think at the very least it's time for a new call to action, because especially just coming back from the Middle East again and seeing how inflamed the region is, the level of anti-American sentiment, not just there, but even in Europe, and we're not even talking about the global South yet, is really off the charts. We are really living in a Disneyland here in this country. There's a bubble. You can feel it when you come in and out of this country and travel abroad. And when you talk to people over there, and what are they saying about this country, the questions they're asking, and then you come back in here, and people, it's almost like most people aren't aware that there's this major crisis. We're not even then talking yet about Iran and what could happen when the U.S. starts bombing that country. Right now, it's looking very much like when and not if. It could happen anywhere from within about a month from now to, I think, at the latest 18 months from now, if radical changes aren't put into place immediately, as in a good start might be starting impeachment processes right away, starting trials, getting the U.S. involved in the International Criminal Court. There's many things that need to happen immediately. But I think it's time for each of us, most people here, I know I'm probably preaching to the choir for the most part, but I think it's each of us needs to decide again, what can we live with? Are we comfortable? Am I comfortable as a U.S. citizen knowing that all of this is happening on a daily basis in Iraq, among other places, and that we're fueling it and paying for it with our tax dollars? And if we're not okay with that, if that makes us a little bit angry or a little bit upset, then I think each one of us needs to decide, what are we willing to do about it? Because I think it's time that we each need to think, what is that next step that I've thought about doing to try to get politically involved or affect some change in this country, but I haven't done it. I haven't done it because I'm afraid, or it's too big of a risk, or maybe it might be financially risky, or maybe I'll look stupid, or whatever reasons we use to not take that risk and do that next thing. And I think it's time for each of us personally to find out what that next step is and to commit to taking that risk to try to affect the change, because this country is in a crisis, and if we don't start creating that change right now, things aren't going to change. So I want to leave everyone with that thought. Please figure out what that next thing is. What is the next risk that you've thought about taking, crazy as it might be? Commit to yourself or a friend to go do it, and start making preparations to start taking that action. Thanks, everyone, very much.
After his talk, one young man in the audience asked about the consequences of massive aerial bombardment of Iran. Dar Jamil.
There's already special operations going on the ground in Iran right now. They've been going on for over a year. There's unmanned surveillance drones. There already have been some bombs set by the covert ops folks. They're trying to pit some of the sects against one another in Iran, the different political groups, that is. They are overflying Iran to launch missions into Afghanistan. They're doing low-level, under-the-radar flights, helicopter flights mostly. And if and when the U.S. bombs Iran. One train of thought is that it's going to happen just before the November elections. Maybe that would be the October surprise. Some things to back that possibility up is that there is a large fleet of naval ships being deployed over to the Strait of Hormuz, some of them with mine-placing ships, which are going to be used specifically for Iranian harbors to try to maintain U.S. control of the Strait of Hormuz, because this is the primary area where half the world's oil resources move through on a daily basis. So it's a pretty important place for this country to try to keep control of that. And then just the fact that if this administration were to lose control of the House, impeachment proceedings might be set forth immediately, and then their backs would be against the wall, successful or not, for the rest of their term, and they don't want that. The other thing is that Bush, according to many of the insiders in the White House, has a messianic vision of regime change in Tehran before he leaves office. And if you look at the other neocons like Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and these people, they have been eyeing this for a long time. And by their behavior, it seems pretty clear with all the saber-rattling against Iran that short of massive resistance here at home, it does look like they're going to try to go for it, which would mean a massive aerial bombardment. We're talking hundreds of targets using massive bombs. They're talking about using bunker busters, these mini nukes, as they like to call them. So we're talking about nuclear war. And China and Russia will be involved immediately if that happens. They cannot afford to have the U.S. take control of Iran, especially since the U.S. is now sitting pretty on top of Iraq's oil reserves. And consequences, according to intelligence agencies, are that immediately we're going to see, basically, as one CIA report put it, southern Iraq will light up like a candle, is how they put it. Southern Iraq is basically Iran at this point, just for to really boil this down to the bottom line facts, that the Badr Army is, it's I think, the most powerful Shia militia in Iraq, is Iranian-trained, armed-funded. They came in on the heels of the invasion forces and are now really in control of most of southern Iraq. The main U.S. supply line goes from Kuwait to Baghdad. That is the primary supply line. It would be very easy for them to lose that supply line. Already, U.S. bases are being mortared every single day. Imagine what happens when they run out of supplies. We're going to see the level of attacks on troops. Right now, they're being carried out primarily by just the Sunni resistance. What happens when the Mahdi army and the Badr then start to take up arms? We're talking 60% of the population of Iraq then being also sympathetic to the resistance against the U.S. So bad news in Iraq for the U.S. military. We're going to see Hezbollah basically use the rest of their rockets into northern Israel. We're going to see other countries that have predominant Shia populations like Saudi Arabia, a large part of Jordan, go on through the rest of the Gulf states. All of those governments, including Pakistan, are going to be immediately destabilized. Basically, Iran would wage economic war on the U.S. immediately by torching the oil infrastructure of the Gulf, which is basically unprotected at this point. There's not going to be anything the U.S. can do to protect that. Oil's going to go up immediately over $100 a barrel. Some people have argued $200 a barrel. What does that do to our economy? It doesn't take a genius to see it's game over for this economy. What happens when people can't fill up their cars? What happens when the cost of, you know, most of our average food article is shipped about 3,000 miles, I think. What does that do to the price of food? I mean, it's pretty easy to do the math that the economy, especially that of the U.S. that is so dependent on fossil fuels, on oil, is going to be in really, really bad shape. So those are some of the gross, overt consequences we can point to immediately. And then there's, of course, cascade effects to all of those. My primary concern is we're talking about a possible nuclear war here. We're talking about using nuclear weapons again on a country. And I don't understand why people aren't going crazy about this.
and then talk about the fact that Russia and China, who just happen to have a whole lot of nuclear weapons themselves, and Israel, who without a doubt would be very prompt to use some of their 300 nuclear weapons if they felt threatened, which they absolutely would if Hezbollah cuts loose again on northern Israel. Just look at the consequences. It's really, really frightening.
To read Jamal's reports, visit his website, darjamailiraq.com. or darjamailiraq.com. This is Carolyn Coe.
You've been listening to a locally produced special here on WERU, produced by Carolyn Coe, and we'd like to thank you for listening to your community radio station, WERU-FM, 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at WERU.org. If you missed any of that or any of our locally produced news or public affairs programs, you can catch them again on our website, WERU.org. Click on the audio archives button. You can also reach us by emailing news@WERU.org. Stay tuned for On the Wing.